to get involved. And I would say that we have to be...
Kenty, we gotta go. We're getting closed out. Thank you. I wish we had more time, but I gotta go. You gotta go. Thank you so much for being on the show today. I really appreciate you.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And one last thing is marksbeyondbars.org.
Okay. Thanks, Kenty. Thank you, listeners.
Thank you.
Keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means.
To engage in any activity
that shall contribute
to a lasting understanding
between nations and between the individuals of all nations,
races, creeds, and colors.
To gather and disseminate information
on the causes of conflict
between any and all of such groups,
and through any and all means
compatible with the purposes of this corporation,
to promote the study of political and economic problems
and of the causes of religious, philosophical,
and racial antagonisms.
That is our mission.
This is Quetzal Flores from the band Quetzal, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 Los Angeles.
This is the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM, covering news and public issues affecting areas students come from, including South and East Los Angeles. I'm Julie Patel-Liss, and on today's show, we'll hear about attacks on press freedom at home and abroad, and more broadly, how misinformation affects the political ecosphere and public policy that affects us all. We'll also learn what we can do to strengthen our press and our democracy in light of these attacks. This conversation, hosted by the Golden Globe Foundation and our Cal State LA Journalism Program, happened ahead of International Press Freedom Day in May. We invited three journalists from various groups advocating for press freedom to chat with moderator Cynthia Harbeau, a senior multimedia reporter with Cal State LA's University Times. Cynthia also covers community news, and several of her stories were cross-published in local news outlets this past academic year. The journalists are Nicole Sadek, a reporter for the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Previously, she was a data journalist at Bloomberg Law, and her work has appeared in The Washington Post, Inside Climate News, The Arizona Republic, and other outlets. Catherine Jacobson from the Committee to Protect Journalists also spoke. She's the group's U.S., Canada, and Caribbean program coordinator. Before joining CPJ as a news editor in 2017, Jacobson worked for the Associated Press in Moscow and as a freelancer in Ukraine, where her writing appeared in outlets including Business Week, U.S. News and World Reports, Foreign Policy, and Al Jazeera. Last but certainly not least is my friend Adam Rose, COO of the Starling Lab for Data Integrity, an academic research center co-founded by Stanford and USC. Adam previously spent over 20 years working for local, national, and international media organizations. He serves on the board of the Los Angeles Press Club and chairs its Press Rights Committee, where he helped lead a group of us to successfully lobby for a new law in California protecting journalists from arrest while covering protests. Now let's go to Cynthia with the first question for our panelists.
Perfect. So my first question for everybody is, what is the current state of press freedom, either in California or globally? And would you say that legal protections for journalists are improving or deteriorating?
Well, I'm not sure who wants to go first. I think for maybe a global perspective, Catherine, would you like to maybe set the table for everyone, and then we can chime in with sort of localized aspects?
Sure. Globally, not to be a harbinger of doom and gloom, but globally, the press freedom outlook is not great. At the Committee to Protect Journalists, we recorded, we keep track of the killing and imprisonments of journalists globally and continue to register, all-time highs, I think, for a lot of those different categories. But focus specifically on the U.S., I think what we've seen is kind of an increase in both tempo and tone of attacks on the media that has been really quite concerning to see, and unprecedented, I think, is the word that keeps on coming up. Perhaps it's used too frequently, but I think it perfectly encapsulates the situation. What we've seen in the first almost 100 days of the Trump administration has been kind of a dizzying number of actions taken against the media to really both make examples of certain news outlets and send a message that narratives that counter with the administration's views and perspectives should not be, given the same kind of consideration as previously they held. And what this really does is both send a message to local journalists in the United States that they too could face pushback. And we've even seen pushback, which I'll let others talk about, I guess, and kind of a restriction of press freedoms at the local level. But it also globally sends a message that the United States is no longer a partner for advocating for freedom of the press, which is of great concern to us as a global organization that has so long relied on the United States in a lot of these different situations to advocate for media freedom.
Thank you.
I would add that I think the state is very complicated and mixed, nuanced as well. And so when you think about the United States and our wonderful legacy in spirit, a lot of people assume that the First Amendment protects us in certain ways. And it does, certainly better than, say, North Korea or Russia or certain other states where it's extremely dangerous to be practicing as a journalist. But let's take a slight even step back from there and say, well, what is the point of a free press? Why does that exist? And for anyone who studies civics or their history, you should have a good sense that, at least in the United States, the whole purpose of this is to ensure an informed public, right? We want the public to know about the things that they're voting on. We want them to be making informed decisions about their elected officials' taxation and holding their elected officials accountable, right? I mean, we can enjoy all the celebrity and, gossip news that we want, but at the end of the day, what matters is usually civics related. And so the ability to be informed is vital to have a functioning democracy. So the state that we have right now is tricky because of many of the reasons that Catherine outlined domestically. In this country, we're facing a number of challenges, whether it's from, federal, leadership setting a certain tone and precedent, which is very problematic, to actual actions that are concerning. Now, here in California, locally, and especially in Los Angeles, we'd like to think sometimes that this is some sort of bastion of social values, and some people might think that it's very progressive. It is and it isn't. While people might hold those political views, some of the laws that we have were, literally going back to the Wild West era. And some of those are good, but some of those are still a little bit problematic. And so we see all the time, literally every single year, there are people in the press advocacy community who are finding new legislation in Sacramento being introduced that would limit access to public records or that would make it harder for journalists to keep the public informed about the things that the public has a right to know. So there's a line that I learned originally from Mickey Ostreicher. He's the general counsel of the National Press Photographers Association. And he said that police will say sort of cheekily, sometime, you can beat the rap, but you can't beat the ride. So even if you have those rights and you can say on the front, skirmish line, hey, I've got a First Amendment right, you're not going to win that argument with a police officer who's telling you to leave. Now, here in California, as you heard earlier, there is new law that allows journalists to remain at a protest when an unlawful assembly is declared. So that's a really good step in the right direction in terms of legislation. But we still continue to see problems in the field where police will violate those laws and go unpunished for years or if ever. And so it's a very much an active concern, even here in California, in Los Angeles, and in places that we would like to assume are more advanced on these issues than even other parts of our own country. Unfortunately, we often find that they're not. So I don't want to say it's great. I don't want to say it's bad, but I will say it's a very complicated situation.
Okay. Thank you.
I might echo a little bit of what Catherine said, domestically speaking. I think in the first few months of the Trump administration, we've seen kind of a retaliatory approach to press freedom. We've seen the Trump administration bar the Associated Press from the White House for the language they've used, calling the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of Mexico rather than the Gulf of America. We've seen the administration sort of, moving to handpick who gets to be in the press briefing room. And they've done so, saying that they want to expand the type of media that's there to cover the administration, which on its own is an honorable thing to be doing. But as soon as a government chooses who gets to cover it within the White House, that's really a dangerous slope to be on. I will say, this is all very sort of doom and gloom, as Catherine said. The U.S. is not the worst place in the world to do journalism. Like Adam said, it's not North Korea. There are a lot of countries, between the U.S. and North Korea that are facing a lot of issues. In countries like Russia, where a news organization can be labeled undesirable, that means that not only reporters who are working for those organizations are committing a crime, but people who interact with their content are also facing sort of dangerous repercussions. And so that's not only dangerous for journalists doing journalism, but it's also dangerous for people who want to be informed by an independent press. And I think that's really what's the most concerning.
My next question, kind of in that same vein, do you have any advice for student journalists who are trying to pursue these investigative projects and how they should operate freely in a kind of restricted environment, especially given recent events?
The first thing to remember is that a student journalist is a journalist, full stop. And the community of journalists understands that fully and will stand with journalists, especially in California, where our laws have been fought over for a long time to ensure when we have these issues come up that we're very careful not to exclude student journalists. So you have First Amendment rights, you have state rights. Knowing those rights is very important. As I said before, you're not going to win a First Amendment argument on the skirmish line with a police officer, but you might win an argument over penal code. And so if you're going into a situation, let's say you're covering a wildfire and believe that you deserve access to a certain scene, which you probably do, or let's say you're going to cover a protest, California state laws are very explicit about permitting journalists to enter areas that are otherwise closed to the public. So before you go into those sort of situations, you obviously have to think about your just general safety and not having something happen to you. But you also need to study up just a little bit. I mean, it shouldn't take you more than an hour and probably even less to get fully up to speed on California's laws relating to press access. And so understanding not only your rights, but the ability to speak the language of law enforcement is very important. So instead of saying First Amendment right, if you say, look, Penal Code 409.5D says I can come in here. Sounds like a bunch of gibberish, but what have the officers been trained on their entire lives? It's enforcing Penal Code. And when they hear you cite Penal Code, they're going to go, uh-oh, if I don't follow that, I'm going to get in trouble because it's my job to know that. Their job isn't to have a constitutional law debate. So if you can speak their language, it's going to help you a lot in those sorts of situations. There's probably 100 other pieces of advice or tips I could give, but let me hand it over to some of the other folks here to give some other practical advice.
Well, this might not be a fun answer, but I would just say that fact check everything. Do not put yourself in a situation where someone can sue you. I mean, like Adam said, student journalists are journalists and they face the same threats of being sued and things like that. After you have followed all of those tips that Adam just gave you, when you are going to protests or going out there, when you're actually sitting down and writing the story, you need to be 100% sure that what you're writing is accurate. You do not want to give any ammo to anyone reading the story to discredit you, to call you fake news, anything like that. So that's, I guess, sort of on the back end of the reporting.
And I would also just say to be aware of the many different organizations, including the Committee to Protect Journalists, that have all these different safety guides out there. We also do, and as do many other organizations, safety training for journalists. So focusing either on physical situations. So a lot of that is around protests and best practices of how to engage in, with, you know, law enforcement, as Adam was alluding to, or as I was mentioning, and as well as online digital hygiene, right? Kind of thinking about both, you know, making sure you have the kind of framework in place to protect your sources. So, you know, who knows what kind of articles you could be reporting, right? Do you want your sources who might want to wish to remain anonymous to be revealed? Probably not. And also to think proactively about online harassment, right? Because the sooner you start thinking about what your online presence looks like and the different ways that that could allow for people to stalk or harass you, the better. Again, like CPJ deals with a lot of the worst case scenarios, and luckily they will probably not happen to you, but they could. And so being prepared for the worst of someone trying to do an intense Google search and figure out where you live or where your parents live or, you know, other relatives or whatever, and protecting against that is essential, right? It's so much easier to put those frameworks in place ahead of time and prevent people from, as much as possible, right? Prevent people from being able to access that kind of personal information about you, rather than trying to clean up after the fact, I will say, because we deal with a lot of those cases and it's very difficult. So better to be proactive.
If I could add to that, you know, pay very close attention to advice that CPJ and other groups put out about device security, physical device security, especially when you're going to protests. And this will, is part of all the sorts of guidance that you'll see out there. Increasingly, we have seen law enforcement officers attempt to open journalist devices, including student journalists who've been arrested at protests. And, you know, there's all sorts of laws that are supposed to protect journalists from that. But it's that line, you can beat the rap, but you can't beat the ride. Once something is already done to you, you know, it's ruined your day, or they've already got your data. So it's important to be proactive on that. That's super important. Speaking of proactive, if I could also add to what Nicole said about making sure you get things right. You know, there's a term that you're probably, you know, if you haven't already learned, you will in journalism school, but the idea of a pre-publication review is the concept that you have lawyers look things over. You're not going to need that for 99% of what you're reporting on a day-to-day beat, but on especially investigative stories or really sensitive things, what the term you're looking for is a pre-publication review, which, you know, lawyers who work in this space understand that very clearly to mean they're looking at things like libel and defamation. They're looking at things that, you know, could endanger your sources. So that's something to, you know, just have in the back of your mind before you hit publish on something or however you're going to put out your story. One of the big changes, you know, I think that we've seen in our industry that's a positive, a lot of negative things, is the coalition building that's happening across journalism organizations. And there's always been some extent of that, but you know, go back a few decades, and traditionally journalism is a pretty competitive field, right? You know, people are trying to scoop each other, they're trying to get the exclusives, and that still happens, and that's still a part of the industry. But people also recognize we cannot be in this alone because there's too much at stake, and so it's okay to be collaborative, it's okay to ask for help, and you know, whether that is with a formal organization or just a peer, collaborate with student colleagues from other student publications. If you see someone out there from a large a journalism outlet who you've seen on TV or you've read their byline, they're probably, you know, going to be nice if you ask for help. When I was coming up as a, you know, a young intern and early in my career, everyone senior to me was so kind and nice with their time. And I've always tried to pay that back. And I think you'll find that most people in this profession are the same way. So you always find a couple exceptions, of course, but the overwhelming majority care about that thing we talked about at the beginning about informing the public. And if they see you out there trying to get it right, they're going to at least give you a hand on making sure you don't get hurt in the process.
If I can just piggyback off of that really quickly, just kind of our best practices, what we recommend for journalists to consider if their phone has been confiscated while they're out reporting, just even if police have not officially asked to unlock the phone, there are technologies that currently exist that, you know, not every single police force has access to, but enough have the potential to have access to. That could get you in trouble, and they would be able to basically, without unlocking your phone, like through a passcode or something, just be able to siphon off information from it. So just to be aware that if the device has, again, been confiscated, left your eyesight, there is a chance that, you know, that the information has been accessed. And the other thing that I'll also just add to best practices is kind of the request for comment, right? I feel like it's a lost art almost of calling up whoever you're reporting on and asking them what their opinion is sometimes, because we're all rushed and there are deadlines, et cetera, et cetera. But making sure that you actually give them time to respond and in trying at least to engage in that conversation, I think is really important. So thanks.
What would you say is the role that misinformation, fact-checking, accuracy, and balance, how does that play into freedom of the press?
So at ICIJ, we have a very rigorous fact-checking process because most of the stories we do put out are longer investigations. Unfortunately, a lot of news organizations don't have fact-checkers anymore. They can't afford it. We are very lucky that we do have fact-checkers. And just to kind of show you under the hood, what we do is we just footnote every fact in the story, and then the fact-checker will go through and confirm all of those footnotes. And I mean, every fact. I was working on a story recently where I was describing a neighborhood and I described the houses as having red roofs. And I put an image sort of as my footnote to show what the houses looked like. And the fact checker looked at it and she said, that looks more brown to me. So we changed it. And that's sort of a very silly example of the facts that we're checking, but just to show you, you know, in how much detail we go through it. And the reason we do that is because, like I said earlier, we don't want to give anyone ammo to claim that we have published something false about them. Lawsuits are very expensive, even if you're going to win them. And lawsuits are what put a lot of news organizations into trouble. People have to be laid off and things like that. So we never want to be in that kind of situation.
There's so much to unpack with that question. And so I think that Nicole's answer is really good. I would add that, you know, coming back to the point of journalism, you know, what is the highest calling of journalism? And it's not to tell two sides of the story. It's to tell the truth. So it's so vital that you do what Catherine says and get the other side and you understand what they're having, what someone's trying to say. But just because someone said the Holocaust didn't happen doesn't mean you have to give that equal weight to the people writing a story related to the future generational impacts of the Holocaust, right? Just because someone says that climate change isn't real and 99.something% of scientists who study this are like, this is real and it's serious, doesn't mean you have to give equal headlines to say climate change isn't real according to some idiot on the internet, right? What are their credentials? What is the context? Now, sometimes it's hard and sometimes there are very important counterpoints that need to be shared with the public so they can make up their own mind. I mean, your job is not to tell the public what to think. It's to help them understand what a situation is and help them make up their own mind. And you can serve as a steward of that, of the information ecosystem that we all live and operate in and depend on. But just because someone says something doesn't make it true. And your job is to try and get to the bottom of that, to find the truth in all of that. The challenge is that it is an ecosystem and it is often polluted by misinformation and other, you know, types of propaganda techniques and things like that. And so you have to learn to recognize that and to be consistent and hold yourself accountable. You know, it's tricky because, you know, certain people have found that as a propaganda technique, never admitting when they're wrong seems to work in terms of certain opinion polls. But, you know, there's a difference between your character and your reputation. Reputation is nice. We would like to have a very strong reputation and we should strive for that. But your character is more important. Get it right. Pursue that. And when something is wrong, because, hey, we're human, you know, allow even for the subject of the story who you're most incredulous about, allow for the fact that they're human, right? They might just be having a bad day. Their mom might have died that day. You know, who knows? Give them a little bit of leeway. Try and understand things from their perspective and then try and get to the truth. And if you ever get it wrong, correct it. Be upfront about it. If you ever go to a doctor or a lawyer or someone who is 100% of the time, 100% certain about everything, at least personally, I'm a little incredulous. And I'm like, is this the right person that I want to work with to trust my own legal future or my health? I go, I'd rather have someone who once in a while goes, gee, I don't know, that's really important. And I'm going to check with another specialist in this area. I'm going to work with someone else and I'm going to be a team because no one is smarter than everyone. And so you have to think about these again as ecosystems of information and how you navigate that with specialists and people to overcome things. And then be consistent in putting out the best possible version of the truth that you can find, the most accurate version you can find. Be honest when there are questions about it. And your character will be intact, and the people who appreciate that, or you know, the ones who hopefully are the ones making you know influential decisions in the world, will base that on your reporting, not on some random person on Facebook they've never heard of. And hopefully your reputation builds from there, but keep your character first and foremost and always aiming to get it right.
I think this is why it's so important to work in teams as well, and kind of have a system in place where you have those checks and balances on the copy that you're working on. Having a strong editor, but having a reporter who has a good relationship with the editor and can push back on different things to really have a dialogue about a story rather than to, you know, just spit something out, I think is essential.
You're listening to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm Julie Patel-Liss. After the break, we'll continue our conversation about attacks on press freedom and what we can do about it. Back to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm Julie Patel-Liss. Now, let's continue our conversation about press freedom, attacks on it, and what can be done about all of this.
Adam, you kind of mentioned like the ecosystem, which leads me to my next question. And considering like the political zeitgeist right now, How would all of you say that technology has impacted the press, and how has corporate ownership impacted press freedom?
Well, also a lot to unpack there. You know, the first thing I would say is, in being a practitioner of media or, just being involved in journalism at all, you're a lifelong learner in this, not just because of the stories you report and the skill set that you develop doing this, but also because the industry is always changing. And so we're dealing with these seismic changes in technology for distribution. But guess what? We've been having that for a long time, right? You know, the printing press going back to Gutenberg, sure, you know, we talk about that. But, you know, radio, television, the way that, things were sent by plane to get stories, you know, newspapers or other print periodicals around the world has all changed things. And so there's constantly an evolution, as well as what we might feel like now is more of a revolution in technology. So the more you study the past history of that, in particular, I think since the 1960s, but even going back further, the more you understand how sometimes these huge changes that we think we're seeing are just sort of things repeating each other over and over. Podcasting. Everyone is so big on podcast. You know, probably six people in the room have a podcast, and you run into someone's podcast, and you don't want to listen to it because, like, I can't listen to everyone's podcast. We've had talk radio for generations, at least since the 1960s, and conservative talk radio was a huge thing. Rush Limbaugh was a huge thing, right? And so people are talking about how the conservative podcast wave buoyed Trump. Sure, that's, to me, in many ways, it's not identical, but it's basically conservative talk radio as it's been for a long time, and the good and bad that can come with that. So I would say it's really important to understand things in the arc of history, you know, first and foremost. Then when you drill into, like, you know, actual things about modern tech and ownership, you can think about, oh, well, we have had FCC licenses and regulation of, you know, broadcasting. We have had issues with, you know, with mergers in the past, and, news consolidation and loss of local news, and then things grow. But that's not to be Pollyanna about it and say it's just going to come back. It's just to say, well, what happened? What fixed things before? What didn't? Learn that is what I would say. And then in terms of technology, the other thing that's fascinating to me, and this comes from my other side of my day job, where we're looking at what we call data integrity. It's how do you know something is not a deep fake? How do you authenticate something? And there's a really cool movement out there around what we call authenticity. And there's a group called, there's a technical standard called C2PA, which you can just call it C2PA, but the full name is Coalition for Content Provenance and Authenticity. And these are companies like Adobe, right, that makes Photoshop, and companies like Microsoft and the BBC and New York Times and Canon and Sony. And they're developing technical standards to prove that the moment light hits the sensor of a camera, all the way to the other moment light comes off the glass of your screen, whether it's a phone or a laptop or whatever, that that's authenticated, that all the ones and zeros of digital data have been proven to be accurate. I think that will increasingly be important in the years ahead. as a society, we're still probably quite a few years out from fully understanding that. But, you know, the same way that we have adopted other technologies, you know, browser security on your computer, you have HTTPS on by default right now. In the last few years, that became really common as a security standard. That was invented in the 90s by Netscape. If anyone even knows what that is anymore. It took decades for that to become common. So some of these technologies that are out there already exist that can help confront some of the problems that we're facing. The whole space that came up of media ownership is really concerning. And I could ramble on about that. So I want to make sure to give folks some chance to talk to you, because I geek out about this stuff. And I know there's some other really good informed people here on that.
I'll say, when it comes to media ownership or corporate ownership, the real question is about editorial independence. No matter what kind of ownership a news organization has, there needs to be a separation between the editorial side of it and the business side of it. Obviously a corporation makes money. It wants to make money. And so sometimes that will lead to, favoring certain stories over others, favoring stories that will get more clicks. And I think that sometimes leaves some stories untold, kind of left back. At ICIJ, we are a nonprofit. We're run on donations from donors. So we're lucky that we really can explore whatever we want to explore. That's something that I'm grateful for. I will also say for technology, we have seen some, negative consequences of technology. For example, governments or companies hacking journalists' phones. There's something called Pegasus spyware. A lot of journalists around the world were hacked by this spyware, and that not only puts the journalist at risk, but also their sources that they speak to regularly. So there are certainly negative consequences. Positive consequences, with social media, for example, I do a lot of reporting where I have to talk to people who live in, Kazakhstan, and it's not so easy to find their phone numbers online and just give them a call, but finding their social media account, much easier to do. So I will say that there are benefits for the reporting process with social media. People are taking pictures of everything and videos of everything these days. They're posting them online. That can help you do those kinds of digital investigations that are, really popular. So I wouldn't say technology has been all bad. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, kind of piggybacking off of that, technology allows for everyone to hold authorities to accountable to account in a way with their cell phones, right? If we think back to the George Floyd protests, how did those start in the first place, right? It was with a citizen recording his murder. But then also it allows for governments to or businesses, private individuals, to surveil with means that we have not seen before, right? But this, again, as Adam and Nicole both said, this is kind of this ongoing evolution. And what I'll just say really quickly about corporate ownership is, I still remember on the first day of one of my journalism seminars, the professor walked in and handed us all a brown lunch bag and said, remember, there's no such thing as a free lunch. Everyone has to get paid somehow. And I think it's really important to understand the different business interests at play and how that could potentially impact editorial decisions. And, I think it's, as news consumers and also as news producers, having that kind of nuanced understanding of where stories are coming from and the potential impetus for certain narratives being forwarded versus others is really important. And
I have to ask this. Are any of you worried about how AI will encroach upon the responsibilities of a journalist?
Yes and no. Again, I think there are really exciting opportunities. I think we could have had a similar conversation in the early 90s or mid 90s, I guess, about the World Wide Web. Kind of as Adam mentioned earlier, right? That like every generation has these kind of different technologies, emerging technologies that they have to deal with. On the one hand, AI could be cast as something awful, right? Spitting out all of this false information that hasn't been verified in a format that looks like a newspaper. On the other hand, isn't it so nice that, you know, there's different avenues for fact checking or, gosh, I'm trying to think of positive AI technologies. Anyone else want to jump in here? Or, you know, helping to curate information to make journalist jobs easier so that that you know, already strapped newsrooms don't have to expend as much labor, you know, figuring out their, you know, social media or something like that, right? So it's give and take.
I, you know, again, come to this idea of, well, look at history and, you know, you can go back to an era where people painted, you know, portraits and the photograph ruined that and it created the headshot industry. And now everyone's taking selfies. Are we, you know, a lesser society for having photography? Of course not. We're so much better off with it, but it did certainly put the, I don't know any people who paint, you know, portraits of, anymore of, as, you know, of like ancient royalty. That's just not a thing, right? But we're in a better place. Go back to ancient Greece. And, you know, I don't want to misstate this, but I, as I understand it, Socrates was kind of against writing things down. He was against writing because he preferred oral discourse and that strengthened the mind and writing made us weak. And Plato had a slightly different point of view. But like the use of technology, you know, has been debated going back for thousands of years. Generally speaking, it's more about adaptability. And so AI has fantastic opportunities for us to quickly synthesize huge amounts of information. I mean, part of the pain of investigative journalism and data journalism in particular is going through massive data sets that no human can individually comprehend. Maybe you need a whole team of people to do it a few years ago. Well, now we can have AI start to surface things. Now, it's vital that we have humans in the process throughout fact-checking and double-checking and rechecking. But if it supercharges your work, that's potentially a good thing. We have to be so careful as well about how that's constructed. And one of the things I always talk about information ecosystems, there's nature and nurture, right? Some of it's natural, but some of it is designed. And so we have to think about the inputs to those systems. You as a journalist should be concerned about the abuse of your material for intellectual property and the value that's created and your copyright and all of those things. You should also be very concerned to ensure that it's included because you don't want to be disenfranchised either as the technology takes off. So there's certain communities that, you know, have been disenfranchised over generations in this country. And if they get left out with the models that are trying to produce information for others to learn or operate in the world, that's going to compound existing problems and could make them substantially worse. So always be learning, always be adapting. Don't be afraid of it, but don't assume it's good either.
To wrap things up, do you think that open meeting laws, open record laws, or whistleblower protections are sufficient enough to encourage deeper reporting?
I can give a very short answer in California, and that's no. I mean, we've got some pretty good laws on the books, but literally every single legislative session, there are bills trying to cut those down. And frankly, if anyone has ever filed a CPRA, California Public Records Act request, you know that it takes months and that people, you know, I think public officials frequently break the laws about those. It disgusts me. I've had requests in, I think at this point for years, asking for things sometimes that are just like, hey, can you give me the manual for this software? Like literally I'm dealing with the LA mayor's office right now and they're, you know, they're giving me the runaround and I'm sending them the law and saying, look, you have a duty to help me with this. And, you know, I don't know what you have in front of you. You aren't giving that to me, but I think you can give me the invoice, you know, the billing paperwork for whatever software you're using, or you can tell me where the guide is. And if you're refusing to give it to me because, oh, it's in this other office, but our office doesn't have it, how do I know that they're not, you know, feeding me a line? And often it turns out that this stuff is more just not releasing records that should be released. So again, we've got really good laws in principle, but in practice, often I think we come up really, really short. And there's often not a lot of teeth for this. A lot of public officials have what they call qualified immunity, where they cannot be held personally liable for improper acts. So the government can be held liable. And we hear about all these great settlements that, you know, different organizations have gotten and journalists have gotten when they've been, say, attacked in the field or, you know, anything else. But, you know, it's always coming back to the taxpayer paying that. And ultimately, it's the same thing with public records and open meetings. When there's a violation, it's never the bad actor, the individual who gets in trouble for it. It's always the taxpayer that winds up footing more bills and you know, wasting more of our resources.
And that's what I think is so important for people to understand is that when talking about press freedom, it's not just something that pertains to journalists and their sources. It's something that affects every single person who pays taxes, because as Adam pointed out, all of these settlements, taxpayer money, the authorities that journalists are reporting on, again, they are working at the behest of the American taxpayer. And so I think also, you know, going forward with the next generation of journalism, framing it as such, as journalists performing a public service in a way to hold these institutions to account, and also to be able to record how money is being spent and if it's being used for the public good, or just, you know, perhaps with less, direct positive intent. So, and framing this session. And to speak more broadly about the U.S., you know, I can point to a few like moments of potential, you know, kind of happier things, right? Of anti-SLAPP regulations being, and SLAPPs are strategic lawsuits against public participation. And so they're basically really expensive lawsuits that shut down coverage in the case of journalists, right? Because it's so expensive to fight against these lawsuits. They can either bankrupt a news organization or just cripple them financially and make it very difficult to cover a certain topic. So there have been, again, these kind of glimmers of hope, as I like to call them, you know, positive things happening at a state level in that respect. But I think more broadly, what is happening in California is very indicative of the broader climate in the country currently about kind of a declining both access physically for journalists to get into certain meetings, and it becoming even more difficult, if possible, to get access to information that is public record. So thanks.
I'll just add one quick thing, which is in regards to open records. Unfortunately, you know, there's been a lot of staff layoffs in the federal government. Some of those people are FOIA officers, the people who are supposed to respond to your records requests. So that is a little scary. You know, when there were FOIA officers, it's not like you were getting your records back very quickly anyway to begin with. So this kind of adds another complication.
You're listening to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm Julie Patel-Liss. I want to thank our moderator, Cynthia Harbeau, Sandra Cuneo, and her team at the Golden Globe Foundation for helping organize this conversation. And, of course, our guests, Catherine Jacobson, Adam Rose, and Nicole Sadek, for their insights. Up next, did you know that podcast ideas are now being adapted into TV series and films? And that the opposite is true as well? Screenwriting professor Ligia Villalobos joins us to talk about her experience switching from one to the other and what she had to learn to do it. Please stay with us.
Welcome back to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm April Brown. Cal State LA is very close to Hollywood, the entertainment capital, and that means many of our professors have close ties and work in various industry roles. Ligia Villalobos teaches screenwriting and has many film and TV credits to her name, but she has also branched out into the narrative podcasting world. She originally wrote Adelita, Changing the Key, as a one-hour TV drama, but when it didn't sell, she eventually found a podcasting home for it. Now, it is being redeveloped as a three-season TV series. Joining me now is Ligia Villalobos. Ligia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You came up with a really interesting idea of a podcast, a narrative podcast, and now it's being pursued on multiple platforms and hopefully going to be distributed in multiple ways. Can you tell me about Adelita, Changing the Key, how you came up with that idea in the first place?
Yeah, sure. So Adelita is actually already out. So it has already been in multiple platforms. What is different about it is that the podcast has now been sold to Skydance to develop it as a one-hour drama for television or for streaming services. But the podcast I did about a year and a half ago, so it was released about a year ago. I'll tell you how I actually started. Somebody at Gael Garcia Bernal, and Diego Luna's company.
Two very well-known actors, we should say, for those who are not aware.
There is a company called Sonoro Media, which is, up to this point, has specifically done podcast content for Latino audiences by Latinos. They were looking for up-and-coming writers to work with, because obviously it's very difficult to get writers who are very established to do podcasts, because you actually don't make a lot of money in podcasting, right? So what they wanted was up-and-coming writers that are trying to get their feet wet as writers, that they're trying to, you know, get their first credit as a writer. That's what they were looking for. And somebody at Gael and Diego's company said, you should talk to Ligia, because Ligia teaches at Cal State LA, and she might have students that might be interested in doing stuff for you guys. So the original meeting with the head of Sonora Media, his name is Joshua Weinstein, was really not about me doing something for them. It was about me giving them names of people that I thought might want to do something with them.
And then how did it change to you doing something for them?
Well, as we were having those conversations, and as I recommended some students that I thought should work with them, we were just having a conversation about what I was doing. And I remember that years ago, I had come up with an idea for a one-hour drama that never sold. And because it's in the music industry and it's music driven, I thought, well, that might actually be a good idea for a podcast. And so I talked to Joshua about it, and I said, you know, I have this idea. They went with another pitch. They never used my pitch. And so I have this idea set in the music world about a young Tejano artist that wants to cross over into urban Latin. And he said, well, send me the 1 hour pitch for it, the TV pitch that I did. He read the pitch and then he said, let's do it. And so that's actually how it happened. I ended up kind of developing out of a 1 hour drama, which is so funny because now it's going to become hopefully a 1 hour drama.
Never throw your ideas away.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's very true, because that idea was over probably 7 years old. And so
you had never thought about it for podcasting until you were having that conversation.
I had never thought about podcasting at all. And I was only familiar with podcasting in terms of like true crime drama, a lot of like docu-series or like talk show type of, you know, podcasts. I didn't even know that there was scripted podcasting being done until I was approached by them.
You are a screenwriter. You teach screenwriting. Did you have to learn some new methods to adapt it to a podcast, or was it pretty easy based on your knowledge?
No, it wasn't busy at all. I mean, you know, when you're working in television or film, which is all that I've ever done, you are working in a visual medium. And so they always tell you, don't tell me, show me. Right? Like that's the main rule that you have to live by when you're doing TV or feature film. Well, it's the complete opposite when you are doing a podcast, because you literally have to say most of what the story is in order for people to follow along. And so it was really kind of like going from left brain to right brain. You know, it was like, okay, how am I going to get people to understand what is happening just with sound? And so there were things that I had to write in the script that I have never written in a script before.
For example,
I'll give you an example. So Adelita walks down a tunnel and we hear the clicking sounds of her cowboy boots as she gets closer and closer to the stage. And we begin to hear the audience screaming for her to get onto the stage. The clicking sounds of cowboy boots, that's not something I ever thought I would ever write in a script. Or if you're in the kitchen, the sizzling sound of eggs being fried on a pound, or like the clicking sound of bowls being pulled down from a drawer, you know, like
Do you then also have the benefit of sound effects to help bring that home? Because that is one of the great things about audio storytelling. If you have the resources, is that at least those sounds along with that narration can help put you in the place.
Well, yes, of course. Yes, we had a whole team of sound engineers and experts and all that that is adding all of that. But when you're constantly having to think about how do you make the scene interesting, so much about what you have to do as a writer is try to figure out what are the things that you can add in terms of sound. So, for example, I had a scene where they do one of their like music rehearsals in the backyard. And so I put there, we hear the water sounds of the pool waves or, you know, something like that. And so we understand that it's not just a regular house. This is like an upscale house that happens to have a pool in the backyard, and you're hearing the splashing of the water in the pool. So things like that, that you kind of need to explain, because they're not going to be able to see this house. They're not going to know that this is like a huge house. And so you have to figure out ways that you're going to express that. Sometimes it was her in a voiceover with her thoughts, you know? As I walk down his house, it is hard for me to believe how much more money he has. The kitchen is twice the size of mine. And so by comparison of what she's doing, of like the kind of star that she is versus the kind of star that she's about to work with, because she is saying the multiple cars on the driveway, the this and that, it's all being said. And then the sound can provide additional, you know, things like that. But, you know, she doesn't know how to cook at all. And so I added, like, the fire alarm goes off and she realizes, yeah, she just burned the egg. So stuff like that will help you and will help the sound people know what kinds of things that they can add to enhance the storytelling.
Was it a completely different team experience working on this podcast than it has been working on your other film and television projects, or is it the same, just the technologies are different?
No. That's also very, very different. First of all, they give you very clear parameters of what you need to do. And usually when you do a pitch for a television show like I'm doing right now, you come up with, let's say, like an 8 to 10 page pitch, and then you figure out how to do that in about 15 to 20 minutes. Nowadays, all the pitches happen on Zoom, right? So you're doing a Zoom pitch. It used to be in person where you go into somebody's office and you kind of pitch the idea. And then they ask you questions or whatever. So the meeting usually lasts, let's say, half an hour to 45 minutes. When you are doing a podcast, at least this is how Sonoro works. If they hire you to develop this for them, you actually have to do a full Bible. So you have to know up front how many episodes you're going to be writing, or how many seasons you plan to have. And then you have to do an outline for every single episode.
Can you explain what a Bible is, just for those listeners who might not know?
It's a document that basically goes from beginning to end of what the story is going to be. So it usually includes like a one-page synopsis, like a log line of the podcast. And then an extended logline, which is a synopsis. And then anything else you want to include in that one page, right? So like there's going to be voiceover, and it's going to be Adelita's voiceover, you know, or there's going to be music, like stuff like that. So it's like a one page. And then after that, there are multiple pages that do character descriptions. Who are all the characters that are going to be in this podcast? And then you describe them, and you basically kind of mention like what the arc in the story is going to be for each character. Where does each character start? Where does each character end? So I had to do a page for each one of the characters that were in the podcast. And then once that was done, then I did like some information about music, because we start in Tejano music, then we go into urban Latin, then we go into traditional Mexican, and we end in Latin American contemporary. So there are four different kinds of music that take you through this entire podcast. So there were pages that were describing what is the difference between Tejano and urban Latin? What is the difference between urban Latin and traditional Mexican? What is the difference between traditional Mexican and contemporary Mexican and contemporary Latin?
You're originally from Chihuahua, Mexico, if I read my homework correctly. And it sounds like you have a very good handle on all of these different types of music and the Tejano culture. Did this story come from your experience in any way? How did you use your life experience or things that you've seen or people that you've met when you're creating something like this?
I have always been very musical. I started playing the piano when I was 6 years old. And then I played the flute when I got to like junior high. So I played all through junior high and high school. And then in high school, I was also in the a cappella choir. And then when I went to college, I became a member of the university chorale. So from a very, very young age, I have always either played an instrument or sang. And I'm also a dancer. My first major was actually a dance major. So music has always been a really, really big part of my life. One of the reasons why I wanted to explore a Latin music world is because there are some extraordinary artists in Latin America, and there is some extraordinary music in Latin America. But it seems like this country only knows salsa or Bad Bunny. And so Adelita does go through this journey where she starts in Tejano, which is what her mother wanted to do, moves into urban Latin because that's where everybody else, she wants to be where everybody else is, realizing that's not really what I want to do at all. And then she rediscovers what Mexican music is today and finds her voice.
Since you are a teacher of screenwriting at Cal State LA, it would seem to me that you are helping students find their own voices and tell their own stories. And with our very diverse student population, what kinds of stories are you seeing coming out of those students?
I teach different kinds of classes. So the one where I get to see that the most is in the pilot writing class, which is the most advanced students that take that class. They get a chance to actually tell their own story. What is it that they want to, you know, talk about? And, you know, funny enough, many of the students are really interested in fantasy and they're interested in sci-fi. And so you get those kinds of stories that you would like just in the general market, you know, where they're exploring a story with fairies, you know, or they're exploring a story that takes place in outer space. But you also get those stories that only their life experience could bring to the screen. Sometimes those stories are heavy. Sometimes those stories are hard. And sometimes those stories are stories that we haven't really seen before.
Ligia Villalobos, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. The show provides news about issues affecting the undercovered areas Cal State LA students come from, including South and East Los Angeles. That's all we have for now. Our executive producers, hosts, and editors for this episode are Professors Julie Patelis and me, April Brown. Cynthia Harbo moderated the panel of journalists, who included International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, Nicole Sadek, Committee to Protect Journalists, Catherine Jacobson, and the Los Angeles Press Club's Adam Rose. And a special thanks to the Golden Globe Foundation for co-hosting the event. Our community news editors this semester are Alia Zavaleta, Andre Rueda, and Christian Rios. Our theme music is Contagious by Mark Vard. Special thanks to our Cal State LA faculty and staff, Christina Hackle, Tony Cox, Joanne Lightford-Powell, Shawnell Curry, Nithin Patel, Andrew Campa, Julian Reyes, Jane McKeever, Joseph Gallegos, Eliel Beltran, Jeff Foost, and Jesus Cruz. I'm April Brown. From all of us at Cal State LA, thank you for listening.
This is Chuck Foster. I host Reggae Central every Sunday afternoon right here on KPFK at 2 o'clock, where you'll hear ska, rock steady, roots, dub, and dancehall. Every Sunday afternoon at 2, right here on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA.